Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome out on this day. The weather tells us that summer is not far away. Beautiful, beautiful times. As is our custom, we give you an introduction to the Philadelphia ULT. Recommend this if this is your first visit, to pick up one of these wonderful little pamphlets before you leave. Because at the top of the pamphlet, it states this: to spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. This is the April, May, June circular. It's evident when you read this, that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principle of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophies, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophers in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophers all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. Below, it states, being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. Today is Sunday morning, April 7th. And according to the declaration, the topic this morning will be Zoroaster, his teaching and legacy. And listed below are the titles for the next few weeks. On Wednesday night, remember, we open the doors promptly at 10:30. Meeting begins, as you see, at 11. And on Wednesday night, it's a study class from 7:30 to 8:30, now in the Ocean of Theosophy. We open the door at 5:15 to 7:15. You have 15 minutes before the class begins, and it's over at 8:30. Now, if you want to ask any questions, ask the usher that you see sitting here in the chair, or the librarian on Wednesday night. Be glad to answer any questions. And as you see, it states here completely, the nucleus, to form the nucleus of universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, color, or creed. So briefly, that is the extent of this wonderful little pamphlet. Pick up one. carry it around with you and acquaint yourself with its contents. Now, without hesitation, before we begin the talk this morning, always there's a little reading that we give. It's from The Voice of the Silence, wonderful little book. When to the permanent is sacrificed the mutable, the prize is done. The drop returneth whence it came. The open path leads to the changeless change nirvana, the glorious state of absoluteness, the bliss past human thought. Thus the first path is liberation. But the path, the second, is renunciation, therefore called the path of woe. That secret path leads the RN to mental woe unspeakable, woe for the living dead, and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow. The fruit of karma, sages dare not still. For it is written, to teach to show all causes, the ripple effect, as the great tidal wave, thou shalt let run its course. The open way no sooner hast thou reached its goal will lead thee to reject the bodhisattva body and make thee enter the thrice glorious state of Dharmakaya, which is oblivion to the world of men forever. The secret way leads to the power of nirvanic bliss, but at the close of kalpas without number. Nirvana is gained and lost from boundless pity and compassion for the world of deluded mortals. But it is said, the last shall be the greatest. Samyak Sambuddha, the teacher of perfection, gave up his self for the salvation of the world by stopping at the threshold of Nirvana, the pure state.
Keep reading, it's not done. It's not done.
Pardon us. Thou hast the knowledge now concerning the two ways. Thy time will come for choice, O thou of eager soul, when thou hast reached the end and passed the seven portals. Thy mind is clear. No more art thou entangled in delusive thoughts, for thou hast learned all. Unveiled stands truth and looks thee sternly in the face. She says, sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of the self, but sweeter still the fruits of long and bitter duty. I renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. He who becomes Pratyeka Buddha makes his obeisance but to his self. The Bodhisattva who has won the battle, who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, for others' sake, this great reward I yield, accomplishes the greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he. Let us listen.
Friends, those who find themselves actively engaged in the true service of humanity benefit from studying the lives and legends of the saviors. Comparing the lives, the legends, and the fundamental teaching of the saviors prepares one to restore to humanity some important facts that have been forgotten or overlooked. The most important fact to realize is that humanity has never been without a friend. The example of their lives, the similarity of the legends of the saviors, and their fundamental and philosophical ethical teachings provides evidence that there exists a lodge of great souls, perfected human beings. From its ranks have come at different times to different nations with different missions according to the nature of their cycle, the Savior teachers, whose common purpose was to impress humanity with those spiritual truths regarding the origin, nature, and destiny of the soul. They may be called saviors, but they came as reformers of any dogmas that might obscure the basic teaching that only humanity collectively and human individuals can save themselves. They came to point out the way to those struggling and suffering in darkness, not to be the founders of any new religion. Nevertheless, their teachings underlie every ancient popular religion, and the inspiration of some of these teachings and teachers were later formulated by their disciples and followers into a new religion with its own rituals, creeds, and scriptures. Since Zoroaster was the founder of one of the oldest recorded religions of humanity, variously called Mazdaism, Magiism, Parsiism, fire worship, and Zoroastrianism, we will begin our study of the lives and legends of the saviors with this great lawgiver and religious reformer. We'll start with the life of Zoroaster, which is a mystery within a mystery within a mystery. The first mystery relates to his name. Zoroaster is the Greek name for the Iranian reformer Zarathustra, which actually is a Zen word, but the Zen language is now extinct. And Zartosht is his name in Pahlavi, or the language of the Persian Empire. The name translated means shining light, or more specifically, the star that contemplates and sacrifices to the living sun. Therefore, it has the same significance as the titles Christos, or Christ, or Buddha. It is the title of an enlightened, initiated soul. He was a great initiate of the Lodge of Adepts, who instructed the peoples who first migrated into Iran. A line of prophets, disciples, and pretenders descended from this being's impulse took the name Zoroaster, adding to much of the confusion regarding to the mystery of his name, birth date, and place of birth. So the second mystery has to do with when was he born? And even scholars differ as to the date of his birth. The Greek Xanthus of Lydia, the earliest Greek writer who mentions him, places him about 600 years before the Trojan War, whenever that was. Aristotle assigns him a date no less than 6,000 years before the days of Plato. And Aristotle would not normally make any kind of remark that he did not seriously understand. Berosus makes him the king of Babylon some 2,200 years BC. Now, modern scholars place him between 1,500 and 1,000 BC. By tradition, and according to the legend, his birth date is celebrated on March 26th as part of the Iranian New Year festival. So it's interesting that his birth date is assigned around the time of the New Year, but also for the Iranians, but also the time of the spring equinox, which has its own significance. In the Persian texts, The name Zoroaster or Zoroaster is referred to in a number of ways, there being 13 Zoroasters named or mentioned, the first of which, or the, rather we might say the 13th of which, the final of which, was the, quote, historical one who was the, whose doctrines became the basis of the religion we know as Magiism or Zoroastrianism. This hierarchy of great teachers given in the Persian texts begin with Zoroaster as a divine being, and the records of the Lodge of Adepts actually claim to have the correct dates for each of these 13 Zoroasters. They were all great teachers, and interestingly enough, the first of these Zoroasters is said to have been a lawgiver and ruler at the earliest stages of the Atlantean civilization when it first developed on the fourth continent. So even in the esoteric books we have of Zoroastrian, it refers to this long line of teachers, of instructors of humanity going under the name of Zoroaster. So when exactly he lived depends on the context, but usually when we study his doctrines and that forms the basis, we are referring to the last of the Zoroastrian line, who is said to have lived by modern scholars about 1,000 to 1,500 years BC. But the third mystery has to do with the actual place where he was born. And here again, there is great variation. Some say he lived in an area just south of the Caspian Sea. Some say he lived in the area of present-day Afghanistan. Some people say he was born more in the area of Central Asia. And some say he lived near the area of the border of Russia and China. So there's a great map of the area, and he could have been born and lived anywhere. And some of it has to do with confusion as to which of these Zoroasters people are referring to. So the school instituted by the last of the Zoroasters, the one we call Zoroaster, who developed the religion that became Zoroastrianism, developed in a vast region, which we were, if to look on the map, would extend from the Persian Gulf in the west to the Pacific Ocean in the east, and from southern Siberia in the north to the Himalayas in the south. So that gives you an idea of the expanse of the influence of his teaching and adherence at that time. So that's what we know of the life of Zoroaster, which admittedly is a mystery. But moving to the legend of Zoroaster, it's more interesting for us here because we can see that there are definite parallels, recurring themes in his legend that relate to the legends of other saviors, teachers, reformers, who worked to raise humanity to a higher level. They all experienced temptation, persecution, martyrdom, and all this symbolizes the life of self-sacrifice, renunciation, and compassion characteristic of a great soul incarnated for the benefit of humanity. And that was what we heard in our reading this morning from the Voice of the Silence. So if we go to the legend of Zarathustra, we can listen to it with an ear to how it sounds familiar in its themes to some other legends and stories we know of saviors. So before the birth of Zarathustra, the evil magicians and wicked people knew that a person who would teach the true worship of Ahura Mazda was to be born to a woman called Dukdova. They wanted to kill her, so that the people would not turn to Zarathustra for help from their wickedness. Her father, fearing for her life, sent her away to the home of a friend, a priestly family, and she married one of the sons, Purushpashna, who became the parents of Zarathustra. When she was 5 months pregnant, she had a dream in which she saw the world was being destroyed, and she was very frightened. But an angel came to her and told her in her dream that she was bearing a great prophet who would be able to change the impending destruction. And as we said, according to legend, on March 26th, she gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Unlike other boys, he did not cry when he was born. Instead, he had a broad smile on his face and was laughing, a sign of the birth of a divine person. His face was shining with a divine glow, and bright light shone all around the house. So his parents decided to name him Zarathustra, which means golden light or golden star. And angels came from heaven to show their respect. Throughout his early childhood, evil men and magicians continuously tried to kill him. But in every case, he was miraculously saved by the intervention of angels. As a young boy, he showed kindness and compassion to all beings. In one instance, he fed and nursed a starving dog back to health. At another time, when there was a tremendous famine causing starvation throughout all the land of Iran, he shared his family food with hungry people. At the age of 7, he began his training in the priesthood, completing it by the age of 15. He showed great wisdom and repeatedly questioned his teachers and challenged them with discussion. Not satisfied with the answers given him by the priests, he left home at the age of 20 to begin what would become a 10-year journey in the search of truth. He spent most of his time in prayer and meditation on the mountains. At one point, Satan offered Zarathustra the entire world if he would forsake his worship. When he refused, Satan threatened to destroy him. One day, when he was 30 years old, he had a special vision of Ahura Mazda, whom he asked to bestow on him divine wisdom. He was granted that wisdom, but told that he would have to use it to instill in the minds of the people the divine truth. His teaching spread across the world, from Europe to China, until he died at the age of 77. He was a reformer who preached against the worship of many gods, ritualizing religious ceremonies, animal sacrifices, and a class system that allowed priests and warriors to oppress the ordinary people. He stressed the importance of individual free will and choice to follow a path of righteousness and truth and to shun evil. The priests, fearing erosion of their influence, began to oppose his views. They continuously harassed him and made repeated attempts to kill him, but he kept teaching. He was eventually assassinated by a man from an enemy country who opposed his teachings. Even after being stabbed in the back by the killer, he turned around and forgave him. He was carried off to heaven by the angels. Moving from his life, his legend, we now come to his teaching. And the teachings of Zoroastrianism deserve more than a lecture in themselves. So what we thought we would do was just highlight a few of the teachings for the point of correcting misconceptions. Because in the mind of the public, there are certain ideas of regarding Zoroastrianism which are distortions of the original ideas, because we don't have the original teachings recorded by in the Zend language, which is now extinct, and the Pahlavi versions from Persia have been reinterpreted and retranslated, and fragments were lost. Much of it was lost during the invasion of Alexander the Great into Persia. So what we have are really scattered fragments that have been put together and tried to be understood, and much of it has been lost. So we are going to look at some of those ideas. So we said that Zoroastrian taught against the idea of worship of many gods. He taught the worship of one God. And sometimes Westerners say, well, he was the first teacher we know of to teach a monotheistic religion or an idea based on the one God. But the conception of a personal God is absent from the original teachings. The omnipresent deity is a central teaching of Zoroastrianism. Ahura Mazda is the universal power who only later became anthropomorphized into an outside personal god. Ahura Mazda tells Zoroaster in the text, "I am that about which everyone inquires and questions. I am the one strength in everybody." The word Ahura Mazda itself means Ahura, existence, Venus, and Mazda means absolute wisdom, pointing to the idea that there is no separateness between the universal oneness and source of all life and wisdom or knowledge of that oneness. Now, the other misconception is it's sometimes believed that Zoroastrianism is a dualistic religion, that there are two beings, a being of good and a being of evil, a god and a devil, if you wish, who have equal powers and are constantly struggling and fighting. Ahura, the one being the founder, the creator of the universe, and the other being the one who constantly tries to deceive and destroy it. So once again, if we go to the original text that we have, these are not opposing beings, but they are not separate, but they are the dual expressions of one reality. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, we read, "Light and dark are the world's eternal ways." And this idea of Ahura Mazda and Angra Manu, or Ormazd and Ahriman, are these two expressions of the one reality. And we might think of it in terms of the duality that we understand in nature: spirit and matter, form and soul, centripetal and centrifugal forces, good and evil. In other words, neither of the light and dark, neither of these realities have any separate existence. In other words, it takes both of them. Both have to be present for them to be balanced and for us to understand the other. We would not appreciate light if there was not darkness, and vice versa. In the human being, that duality represents the spiritual and the material elements in man: the evil passions, animal instincts, personal selfishness and perspective on one hand, the divine spiritual ego and individuality on the other. The third idea is that Zoroastrianism is widely known as the religion of fire worship. And while it's true there are certain practices regarding maintaining a fire in the community, in the household, and keeping flames burning, the fire there is a symbol of spirit and the reincarnating ego, the divine ego, the spiritual ego, who is the spectator, the purifier, the warrior, the strong and immortal part of our nature. So we read in the text, the fire soul blesses anyone who brings to him dry wood. In other words, deeds free from the moisture of passion, well cleansed with godly intent, well examined by the light of day. In other words, performed from a good motive. This fire assists him, but fails not to handle those who are inimical to him. Once again, echoes of that idea of karma, the law of cause and effect, action and reaction, which is a response to the way we act. We bring upon ourselves the results of our own action. Most important, especially to the people living their lives in struggle and darkness, were not necessarily the metaphysical, philosophical ideas, but the practical ethics, which have their basis in the philosophical teachings. So just as he taught that there was a duality in the universe, a spirit and material aspect, there is a spiritual and material aspect and human being. And the theme of Zoroastrian ethics is ashoy, a word that means purity. Ahura Mazda says, for man, purity is the greatest good, even from his birth. Make yourself pure, O righteous man. Anyone in the world here below can win purity for himself, namely when he cleanses himself with good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. And those three, good thoughts, good words, good deeds, we might say is the single mantra of the Zoroastrian, that they in fact repeat it to themselves at different times of the day and in their prayers. The idea being that we try to bring ourselves in unity with the divine, with our higher nature, through cleansing and purification of our nature, through the practical expression of good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. So this purity had two aspects. One was purity of the inner nature of the human being, brought about by good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. The other had to do with purity of the outer life. And this was meant to try to maintain a purity in the very elements of nature, air, fire, water, earth, because of the intimate connection between nature and man. It was taught that we had to try to keep not only our inner lives pure, but our environment as pure as well. And so many of the laws and practices of the Zoroastrians are based on this idea of keeping their environment pure and clean from contamination. So finally we come to his legacy. Why do we even consider Zoroaster, aside from the fact that his life and his legends and his teachings remind us that there are these teachers, these saviors, this fraternity of perfected human beings who are constantly working to lift up their fellow human beings. Aside from that, we should realize the important influence that he, his impulse, and his teachings have had throughout history, even up to this very day, literally this very day. And so what was once the most powerful and influential religion in the world is now one of the smallest and seemingly uninfluential. There are only about 83,000 Parsis in the world today, mostly from Iran and northern India. And one of the reasons they are such a small number of devotees is they don't believe in proselytizing or converting to the religion. To become a Parsi, you actually have to be born in a family of Parsis. Nevertheless, the legacy and impact of Zoroaster's mission and teaching, as we said, continues to today. At one time, Zoroastrianism was the official religion of the Persian Empire. Its teachings influenced Judaism because for a long time, the Israelites were captive in Babylonia and had great exposure to the Zoroastrian teaching and ethics. And there are many common threads in the two philosophical systems of Judaism and Zoroastrianism. Also, it had influence on Christianity and Islam. Its cultural impact was felt very deeply by the Greeks and Romans. And we know for a long time there was this enmity and warfare between the Persian Empire and the Greeks, and there was a time when the Persians took over Greek lands, and at that time the Greeks were very much a religion of worship of many gods. And then you had the Zoroastrian influence in Persia of there being one God, but also that of the importance of free will and choice of the individual to determine one's destiny. And that influence of the Persian Empire had a great impact on the Greeks and Athens and was one of the factors that led to their fierce belief and conviction in independence and democracy. So we might say, it had its influence that way, and of course, influence in the Roman Empire. The influence of his teachings continued in the intellectual history and development of Europe during the Middle Ages, Renaissance, and Enlightenment, when he was regarded as a wise man who understood the secrets of nature. The Florentine Neoplatonist Marsilio Ficino regarded him as the fountainhead, the source of the entire Platonic tradition. He was regarded as the foremost lawgiver and authority on the immortality of the soul by the Renaissance philosophers. During the Enlightenment time, Zoroaster played a prominent role in novels, music, philosophy, literature, and drama. He is referred to and characterized, and his teachings are referred to in the writings of Voltaire, in Handel, in Mozart's The Magic Flute, in Shelley's poetry, in Goethe's works, and of course, we all know Strauss's work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, the theme of which became popularized in The Space Odyssey 2001, the opening. So Strauss was very much influenced by Zarathustra's teachings. Now, moving into modern times, the impact, the subtle impact of this teacher who lived so many thousands of years ago is threaded throughout our culture. And we can begin with Star Wars. The whole idea of the light and dark side of the Force is purely Zoroastrianism. And we know that that's a central theme. And we're coming up, of course, to the most popular television series ever, the Game of Thrones, that's ending. And the one of the central characters in there, that for those of you who follow the books, Azor Ahai, is based on Ahura Mazda, a being of light who defeats and overcomes the darkness. And if we move to the this very year and the movies that come out, we are exposed again to Zoroastrianism in the movie The Bohemian Rhapsody, based on the biography of Freddie Mercury, who was a Parsi. His real name was Farrakh Bulsara. And several times in the movie, you hear from him and his father refer to the ethics of Zoroastrianism as good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. And very often from this platform, you'll hear the same idea of we generate our karma, or we can improve our lives by good thoughts, good words, good deeds. That threefold idea is purely and goes back to Zoroastrianism. And finally, we want to mention that from the point of ULT, Zoroastrianism has a very subtle influence, because B.P. Wadia, who was a very well-known and influential Indian theosophist, first in the Theosophical Society and later working with Robert Crosby, and after the death of Robert Crosby, helped spread the founding of ULTs all over the world. He is directly responsible for the founding of ULT in New York, and was here in Philadelphia and helped stimulate the lodge's growth in this area, giving talks at the Academy of Music, which was packed because he was a well-known figure all over the world outside of theosophy. And of course, students from Philadelphia would drive to New York to study and with the students there, and also discuss with him. So he was a Parsi, from a Parsi family. He wrote extensively on Zoroastrianism, its true basis, and we have on the book table a series of articles called Ancient Landmarks. And the first four have to do with Zoroastrianism, and those works, those articles are taken directly, practically word for word, from his writings, B.P. Wadia's writings on Zoroastrianism. So we are continuously influenced right till today. So we've tried to give you a feeling for how this individual, who we tend to overlook as part of that long line of saviors, but who stands on an equal import as those we know as the Buddha, the Christ, Krishna, in terms of his influence and continually influence on the minds and hearts of humanity. So we welcome your questions or comments on this time as you may have them. Yes.
Was there much influence between Hinduism and Zoroastrianism? Because they seem, in Hinduism, there's millions upon millions of gods, mm-hmm. but of course they have a trinity, and apparently in essence they really do believe in one force.
But yes, but in their exoteric form of the religion, there are many different gods, and sometimes very local gods as well, as you're pointing out. So going back to a very early time, there was one religion or body of teaching from which both religions evolved. Zend was the ancient tongue or language of the Zoroastrianism, just as Sanskrit was the ancient tongue of the Hindus. But both languages evolved from a common source. So whereas Zoroaster fits in, we said he was a reformer. At one point, there was a migration of the population out of Aryavarta, or India at that time, into the lands of Iran. And as we said, Iran was a much larger, considered a much larger area than it is now. Notice the similarity between the word Aryan, which refers to the Central Asia area and the origins of India, and Iran. So as he was a reformer, and he, in a sense, was, as these people left India, he was the one who instructed them and reformed their notions, basically about the idea that rather than worshiping all these multitudes of gods, to focus on the realization of there being one source. Now, he taught the idea of there being angels and higher spiritual potencies. He was one of the first to publicly teach that, and that influence pervaded Christianity and Judaism. He was one of the first to teach about the ideas of post after death states in terms of how we spend our time there depends on the thoughts, words, and deeds we set into emotion now. So yes, in their origin, they were very closely connected. And so one time in Iran, around the 8th and 9th centuries AD, when there was tremendous persecution of the Zoroastrians by the Islamic people in that area, a small group of them left and went to northern India, and they became known as the Parsis because they came from an area in Iran called Parsi or Parsa. And so that's the origin of the name Parsis. And they continue to live in North India, but also they also have close relations with their fellow devotees who still live in Iran. Yes.
Well, even taking that to Buddhism, they say your thought, word, and your deed is how you create the universe. But Buddhism is also a whole lineage of Buddhas. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that the influence of Zoroastrian was very strong. Well, it was on Hinduism, and Buddhism is Reformation Hinduism. So, this lineage of Buddhas, can there be any kind of analogy? Well, there's an analogy between that and the Zoroaster, but could it be the same idea, just clothed in another tradition?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same idea in the sense that these individuals were not unique, separate from us. They were the titles earned and assumed by certain great personages who reached a certain state of enlightenment, wisdom, compassion, and power. And in different areas of the world, were given the titles appropriate to that name. And so throughout the Buddhist tradition, we read of there being a long line of Buddhas. The one we know of is Sakyamuni Buddha, but even there is a Buddha yet to come. And we have a long line of Zoroasters, and there is supposed to be a Zoroaster who will eventually come, and who has a special name as a savior in the future. And we see the same idea in the idea of Christ. Now, many Christians think of Christ as a unique individual, but it is actually a Gnostic term referring to a candidate or Christos who reached initiation and enlightenment and was given the name of Christos or Christ. And so even there we have the idea of, in Christianity, of the reappearance of Christ in the future. So we see this idea pervading all cultures of there being a long line of teachers, reformers, savers in the past and who are expected to be with us today and also come back in the future to help on with humanity. It's a common underlying theme. Yes.
So it was stated that there were 13 Zoroasters, and we've read that there were actually 13 Solomons as well.
Oh, it's just,
that Solomon is a title rather than an individual. And of course, Solomon, the sun or fire, and Zoroaster, the fire worshiping, and that everything in its essence is actually fire. So we're wondering if there was any influence between those two cultures, like the.
Well, once again, we're talking about the time of Solomon, connected with the first temple, and in the Jewish tradition, with the destruction of the first temple, there was the Babylonian captivity and several hundred years in Babylonia, and Babylon at the time. When the Zoroastrianism first took root there, the king there was very tolerant of other religions and allowed them to exist. And we know that there was a school of Judaism that grew up there, mystical, and carries much of the traditions. And we see elements of the traditions of that system also in Zoroastrianism. So there is reference to a Babylonian Talmud, Babylonian Kabbalah, and so we see that there's that cross-fertilization of ideas as a result of peoples living together. So you mentioned Solomon. The same way in India we have the idea of Vyasa, the so-called author of the Bhagavad Gita. Once again, there being several different Vyasas. Same way in Egypt, certain titles, for example, Hermes, not just one individual, but a whole line of instructors that went under the name of Hermes. And the same thing happened in Egypt as happened in Iran, that individuals came after him who borrowed the name and either were loyal to his ideas or changed them, but kept the name Hermes. And so the Hermetic fragments we have today are not always faithful echoes of the original teachings. And yet even there we still see some true ideas creeping through. So once again, the value of this comparative teaching is to help us see that there is one light or one source of knowledge, of wisdom, that is the foundation of all great systems of ethics, all great systems of science, all great systems of philosophy, because they are based on universal truths. Truths that relate to our spiritual world as well as to our material existence. Well, we were thinking, you know, in order to ask questions, sometimes you have to know something enough to be able to ask the question, and it occurs to us that most of us do not have that background or training in Zoroastrianism. It's just not doesn't, as a system of religion or philosophy, it's just not prominent in our minds, and we can understand why. It's ages since it did have that influence, and there's only very few adherents now. And even in the teachings of theosophy, when they're brought up, they're brought up more as from a philosophical and ethical point of view to show that there was this teacher at a time who did have a profound influence and was an instructor and echoed the teachings of theosophy. We thought another useful thing to leave our subject with is, since we are not that familiar, you know, if we were to ask ourselves, well, we know about the Bible and we know about the five books of Moses and we know about the Bhagavad Gita and some of the books of Buddhism, but the whole scriptures relating to Zoroastrianism are a mystery to us as well. So we thought we might ask, just clarify a certain, some of the terms, but did you have your hand up?
We found it interesting because some of the things that we're talking about, there are parallels to Quetzalcoatl as well.
Quetzalcoatl, yes.
In South America. Mm-hmm. And not too long ago, there are certain skulls that had been found in Peru that were unusual compared to the rest of the natives. And just recently, they were identified, the DNA in the skulls were identified, and it was only two of the 18 that were measured had a mix from local Indians.
Mm-hmm.
The others, the haplogroup, the center of mass of that haplogroup is exactly where you're talking about. They were from the Caucasus Mountains.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting, these people came all the way over here, and we see that in the religion of South America.
We see similar ideas. We did have our talks on South Americas a couple months ago, and in a sense, this is a continuation of that, because we are really looking now at the influence and the pervasiveness of these teachings, not so much in the Americas, but in Europe and Asia in this month. So we did want to close here with just a mention of some of these terms. So we hear the word Zend Avesta, which is the general name for the sacred books of the Parsis. It's equivalent to what we would call the Bible. However, it's different. It's not a series of stories. It's really more commentaries and explanations on Avesta, the law. And it's broken up into several parts, just as the Bible is and the Vedas are. There is the Vendidad, which is actually a collection of fragments on purification and the prevention of sin and contamination. As we said, there are two levels of purity. One, the inner purity we maintain in ourselves, and the outer purity of the environment. There are the Gathas, which are actually the oldest of the sacred texts, which are the direct teachings of Zoroaster, or rather the recorded dialogues of his visions and communications in the texts with Ahura Mazda, the spiritual source. So they're in the form of revelations or dialogues, and some of the quotations we gave you this morning, where Ahura Mazda is teaching to his disciple Zoroaster, just as Krishna speaks to Arjuna, is from those Gathas. So we have the Vendidad, the Gathas being all parts of this Zendavesta, this general collection. But the takeaway point is that what we have now of these sacred books have gone through a long series of interpretations and arbitrary commentaries and translations. And so a lot of the original spirit and meaning of the original teachings are lost. And if we are interested, we have to do some research on our own through the aid of the teachings to convince ourselves what those original ideas were. So we'll, at this time we'll close, just to remind you that next week we are going to continue with the legend and life of another world savior, that of Krishna. So our meeting is adjourned.